Hi, my name is Emily Chadbourne, and welcome to Unashamedly Human, the podcast, where we explore how we can better understand our thoughts, feelings, and actions, change our results, and feel less alone as we navigate that crazy thing called life. This show is sponsored by absolutely bloody nobody because, well, no one is willing to pay me for this shit yet. But I am a huge believer in supporting other small businesses that I love and fellow entrepreneurs who, like me, are trying to make the world a better place. So if you hear me recommend or promote other coaches, products or services, please know that it's not an ad. I just want to share the love. Also, though, if you did want to sponsor me, I would completely be okay with that. So you could email me at info@emilychadbourne.com. Do Chanel sponsor podcasts?
Hello and welcome to Unashamedly Human, the podcast. This is episode 11. I am your host, Emily Chadbourne, and I'm here today with my biggest sister, my eldest sister, Laura, who has so kindly agreed to be interviewed today, mainly because I bullied her into it. Thank you for doing this. And the reason I wanted to interview my sister Laura is not because she's more interesting than my other sister Jenny. I just need to say that. It's just that I haven't asked Jenny yet. And also, I thought that listening to me the whole time might get boring quite quickly. But actually, what I really want to do is start bringing in some guests to talk about what it is to be a human being. And those guests don't necessarily have to be leaders in their field. I just want them to be normal human beings. And you're one of the most normal people I know.
Is that an insult or a compliment? I do not know. How's your sister, Emily? Well, normal.
My sister's well normal.
Which is, I think we can describe Laura as normal.
Normal. The greatest compliment one could bestow upon a person.
You must be slightly boring, I feel.
Oh no, you're not boring at all. You're just normal. What I mean is, you articulate yourself very well. You articulate your emotional being quite well on the scale of people that I speak to as a general rule. I think you're quite insightful and I think you're brave and courageous, and I think you manage or are in the process of unpacking and managing your emotion. You're in the process of being unashamedly human. And I think the more that we can share that kind of stuff with each other and in our communities and listening to it on podcasts, the more we feel united in being the sort of crazy ass normal person that we are. I don't think many people are having conversations about how hard life can be. And if they are, then it's sort of always with that kind of like sheeny, shiny perfectionist model, which is ironic because I think we're going to end up talking about perfectionism.
Absolutely.
Today anyway. Because you are one.
Thank you.
So this leads me into my first question, funnily enough. What's the hardest thing about being a human being for you?
The hardest thing about being a human for me is... perfectionism has a lot to do with it. So I would say that I am a recovering perfectionist. Ooh. I've heard that. No, that's not my tone of phrase.
Oh, I'd have totally stolen that.
Good friend of mine.
I've totally stolen that.
Who uses that phrase. But that's it, you know, it's a bit like an addiction. Well, I guess it is a bit like an addiction. It's something that you have to work at every single day. Otherwise, you kind of revert back to it. It's very easy to revert back to that state, I think. So for me, perfectionism is kind of a bit about control as well, I think. And, and has a lot to do with people pleasing too. So it's about people pleasing, control, and wanting to be the best, you know, the things being perfect. So for example, I'm very pleased to be here. I did need a little bit of convincing because I had your kind of tight butt, sweaty palm moment thinking, oh my goodness, what if it's not good enough? You know, what if it's not good enough? What if I stutter over my words? What if I, you know, and that's And that's just, and then I had a word with myself and I was like, no, that's your perfectionism. So put that to one side and just sit down and chat to him. That's what I mean.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how perfectionism has manifested in your life for you. So what does that look like on a sort of day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think it's to do with control and just wanting to, a lot of it is wanting to be in control of situations that you're not in control of.
Yeah, it's a fucker, isn't it?
It's a fucker, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And it's exhausting as well. It's exhausting trying to be in control of situations that you can't be in control of.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you're a mother as well.
So yes.
You can't control those two.
No.
They're gorgeous.
Have you met them?
I adore them.
I can't control those
but
two.
But they're uncontrollable.
Not that I shouldn't be controlling them today. That's the whole point. You're not supposed to be in control of them.
Yeah. I talk to my clients a lot about surrender, this idea of like allowing life to move through you and not like move past you so you don't really notice that you're living. I mean, like in recovery, in AA, they call it life, doing life on life's terms, and you can't control so many elements of life. And yet, especially as a perfectionist, and I think whether or not you suffer with perfectionism as one of your strategies to try and remain in control as human beings, we're constantly in the pursuit of certainty. We want familiarity, which is why I think sometimes, like you call it like an addiction, because it's the place that you go to that's familiar. What do you think the difference, because I'm not a perfectionist, I think sometimes I can find myself running perfectionist strategies around certain things at certain times in certain contexts. Like this podcast, for example, took me a long time to really settle into not giving a shit about whether or not it was right or not. But as a general rule, I'm a bit more slapdash. I think of all three of us sisters, we would describe me
slapdash?
As the slapdash one. The one that fell out at the end and then slapdashed her way through life. La 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 la. But what do you think, where do you think this sort of perfectionist tendency came from? Do you think you were born with it? Do you think it's because you're the eldest? Do you think it was, because we came from the same, sometimes I look at us, the three of us, and I think, how the fuck did we come from the same parents?
Well, we weren't parented in the same way, were we? That's the thing as well. And I think it's a lot to do with you, where you are in the family. I think there are definite traits. There's that fantastic article, isn't there, about three sisters if they were on a road trip, and that kind of sums, do you remember that? It sums
you
us
sent
up
me that.
It sums us up beautifully. So three sisters preparing for the road trip. The eldest will have plotted the route, will know where all the service stations are on the route, will have made sure that the car is filled up with petrol before she goes, will make sure she has wholesome snacks for all her family. You know, she's just controlling on it. She knows, she's prepared for every single eventuality. The second one will, you know, get petrol on the way, you know, might have a few treats, or maybe not, she'll just buy them on the way. She kind of knows where she's going, but they'll work out as they get there. And the third one literally is in the car along for the ride, has had not had any of that responsibility, and just rocks up, doesn't really even know where she's going.
Yeah,
you know, and that is us, isn't it?
It is completely, that is totally us, absolutely. And you know, for a really long time I worried about that when I grew into sort of adulthood, because conversely, from the perfectionist strategy, that is the strategy of sort of obtaining control by releasing it. When I feel like I have too much responsibility, I feel like that is, I can't control it. So my way to control that feeling is to just release it altogether.
Yeah.
And so as I got more and more aware as an adult of how you and Jenny especially were kind of doing life, and I think when mum kind of stepped down from being the matriarch of our family as she got a little bit older, before she got ill even, and you know, you started hosting Christmas, and then you and Jen would take turns in hosting Christmas, and I realised I was still sitting at the kids' table, like literally still sitting at the kids' table, and somehow not even having to do the washing up duties because the kids were doing them now. I was like, how have I managed to manipulate this? Yeah, I don't have a role. And it was very much the role of jester and joker. And I think I got away with it for a really long time until I realised that the strategy that I was playing around that, which was, I don't really want to take much responsibility for my life. But equally at the time, I was earning $20 an hour waiting tables for a living. And there's nothing wrong with earning $20 an hour waiting tables for a living, but it was a massive shock to me to realise that I'd spent so long being the baby of the family and refusing to take that sort of responsibility for myself. And I don't really remember Mum and Dad letting us get away with stuff. Mm. I just think I must have got away with stuff.
Yeah, no, you got away with it.
Did I?
Yes, yeah. Right to the, you know, watching Jaws when you were three and, you know,
I shit myself watching all of that stuff.
It's just, it's, you know, by the time parents get to number three, you know, they've tried and tested it out on two other kids, so they feel like they know what they're doing, and they just take the reins off a little bit.
Yeah. She'll be all right, that last one.
And now look at you.
And now look at me now. But I've had to self-parent quite a lot. Mm. And I feel like you've always self-parented.
Yeah.
I feel like you've always had very high expectations, but I always feel like you've had quite clear boundaries with yourself, whereas I have had to really work at putting those in. And I don't think one is particularly right or one is particularly wrong.
I think, I don't think that there's a right answer to that. I think sometimes the boundaries are too, you know, some, you could say that the boundaries are too much sometimes as well. Talking about responsibility, that's something I'm working on an awful lot at the moment, just in my head, to make my life easier on myself and to get over this perfectionism, control, responsibility, because it has felt, I think my darkest moments of my life have always felt when it's the overwhelm of responsibility that I feel for not just myself, but for other people. Mm. And I am starting to learn, talking about putting in boundaries, I'm really starting to learn now how to know what is in, talking about control as well, so what is in my control, what is my responsibility, what is my remit of responsibility, where does my responsibility begin and where does it end? Mm. And just to kind of let go of the stuff that I'm not responsible for, you know?
Yeah.
I am not responsible for example, somebody else's reaction to me.
Mm.
And that's such a bloody hard thing to
I know, because you think you're the centre of everybody's universe,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, and Sharon looked at me weird.
You feel responsible for what someone's, you know, if you say something, what are they going to say back? But you can't control that and you have no responsibility over that. That's not what you can... You could only be responsible for your actions, your thoughts, your behaviour. And you can't control or be responsible for
other people's. Yeah.
And I'm only just starting to live that, like put that in practice.
Because I remember you telling me that years and years and years ago, Dad had said something which pissed me off. Which, let's be honest, has happened more than once. We love you, Roger, but, you know, he said something and it triggered me or I was upset by it. And I remember you saying, well, you're not responsible for Dad's reaction to you. And that was when I was, like, in my really early 20s. So we're talking, God, how old am I now? Shit, was that 18 years ago?
That was a while ago, yeah.
Oh, God, I'm well.
And now you're belaying our age as well. That makes me even older.
38 and a half. And so what I think is interesting that you've just picked up on there is this idea of like you're only beginning to embody or live that now.
Yes, because I'm very, I think everybody is, isn't it? Very quick and it's very easy to give advice, suggestions, recommendations to other people. I mean, we do it all the time and we know how... We want to treat our friends. We know how to sort of give other people advice. But it's, well, I guess for me, I wasn't even aware that I wasn't taking that advice on.
Mm.
And now I'm aware that I haven't been taking that advice on, even though I'm I was able to articulate to other people, but I wasn't living it.
Yeah. That's reminded me of something someone asked me the other day. They said, well, how do you practice self-love and self-care? Because, and I think you and I probably have both done this in our time, thinking that self-care is about making sure that you have a massage or a manicure, but actually self-love and self-care, as I am beginning to discover, is about having the balls to be uncomfortable with the parts of you that you have tried to suppress or repress or control. That is self-love and self-care, is saying, okay, I'm going to look inwards here and grow my self-awareness, and I'm prepared that that isn't going to be comfortable, but it is going to be worth it ultimately. And I remember someone saying to me, you know, how do you practice this idea of self-love? Like, I don't know how to be that kind to myself. And I said, but you've loved somebody. So if you can love a child or a sister or a parent or a friend or a partner, you know what it is to hold them and tell them it's going to be okay. You know what it is to say, actually, you're doing a really great job, even though you don't feel like it right now. And so you do know how to self-parent. You do know how to self-care. It's just that you've never had to do it, because the comfortable feeling, the familiar feeling, is the feeling of being berated by yourself. It's the feeling of bullying yourself. It's the feeling of giving yourself unrealistic expectation that you are then certain that you are never going to live up to.
It's setting the bar too high for yourself, isn't it, the whole time? I think for me, I get what you mean about, you know, or self-care, that means, you know, what happens if I can't afford a massage and all that sort of thing. But actually, for me, self-love and self-care, the very, very basic fundamental thing of that is how you talk to yourself. So, and I am being really mindful and conscious now about how I talk to myself. And actually, I'm finding that the more I'm kind to myself in my thoughts and my I might be literal, because obviously I do talk to myself, literally talk to myself sometimes, you know.
What's that, Laura? Oh, just yourself.
It's just me chattering on. But the more you do that, actually the more independent you become as well, because then you're not reliant on other people, because you are looking after yourself and being kind to yourself.
I love that. The more independent you can become. Because I think sometimes the irony of monitoring that kind of like self-chatter and self-talk is that a lot of the time people feel like they need external validation for themselves.
Guilty.
And I guess
all the time.
To an extent we do, because we are, by nature, our DNA is built for connection. We are tribal animals and we live in community, and literally there are studies now that show that loneliness is like one of the biggest killers, because your hormonal chemical balance is dependent on it, but also your mental health, and your mental health will have that massive knock-on effect then to how you feed yourself and how you exercise your body, and therefore the sort of secondary diseases that come when you haven't got that sort of care in place for yourself. So, you know, loneliness actually kills. But so many people are looking externally for the validation of themselves that they don't know their own self. They can't hear their own voice. They can't hear their own direction. And I think...
And it's great to get external validation. Everybody loves it. But at the same time, again, that can be a bit of an addiction as well. I was finding, before I kind of started this kind of, you know, self-love kind of thing, I was finding that I was just constantly chasing after external validation. I constantly needed somebody to say, you're doing a good job, you know, you're doing brilliantly, aren't you amazing, you know, through social media or through friends or through whatever, that there had to be, or through emails, through work, you know, I constantly needed that validation. And where does that end? That, you know, that it has to come from somewhere else as well. It has to come from yourself as well.
Yeah. And the thing is, if everybody is needing that, then the cycle just kind of like continues, isn't it? Yeah. Everyone then gets so sort of self-obsessed with finding a way to validate themselves. And I think we do see that on social media now. I mean, neither you nor I particularly put pictures of ourselves up in bikinis. There's a reason.
There is a reason.
But you see it. There's a huge influx on that. And like, you know, watching, you know, your eldest daughter is 15 now, which is petrifying to me, even more petrifying to you, I'd imagine, but like watching social media and teenagers and, you know, like ensuring that your teenager has, or your teenagers, second one nearly, you know, has that sort of healthy self-esteem. And I think it's funny how, as a parent, supporting and nurturing self-esteem in your child has been so much easier for you than doing it for yourself. Because your daughter is full of self-esteem.
Yeah, no, she really is. I'm not entirely certain how that happened. That's more luck than judgment, I feel. But also, you know, hopefully now, I mean, you know, I'm sure there's quite a few people who are parents who might be listening, and if you're a parent, you get it. I mean, everybody gets just quite what a monumentally scary and difficult and responsible job it feels. And that, you know, for a recovering perfectionist, it can sometimes feel really, really overwhelming and really hard. But what I'm now telling myself is, whenever I act in a way that I would not, you know, wish them to see, or that I just berate myself for, and I go, oh goodness, why did I do that? You know, that was the wrong thing to do, or that, you know. What I try and do now is, firstly, be kind to myself and go, well, actually, no, you were human. You acted as you saw fit at that point. You can't be, you know, you're not a saint, you are a human being. And secondly, I just think, if I can role model now self-love to myself and being kind and building up my own esteem, and sort of just by being, just kind of show them how to be, then that's all I can do.
Yeah. And how to be in a way that isn't perfect.
Yes.
So how to fuck it up.
Yes, how
it's
to fuck
okay
it up.
It's okay that I'm going, to fuck and it up. You apologise to your children
a
lot.
Yeah, I do apologise a lot.
I think that came out wrong.
No, I do though.
But
I
you do when if you I, lose your shit, when
I,
you...
Which I do on a, you know, semi-regular basis. I do, and I get angry with them, or I get cross with them, or I, you know, all of those things happen. But once we've calmed down, I always go and say sorry.
Yeah. And I think that's something that parents, this is sweeping generalisation, but I have heard clients of mine come to me and say that they find that really difficult, because they feel like they just need to reassert their control over the situation. Mm. So they find apologising is almost like a weakness, if that makes sense. Mm. Whereas actually, I think you turn it into a strength. And I think that's potentially where some of that self-esteem comes from.
Thank you. That's a nice thing to say. I think, you know, everybody is doing their best, aren't they? You know,
you taught this
to me. I remember you saying this to me years and years ago. Everybody's doing the best with the resources that they've got.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just muddle through and you do what you can.
Do you think you've always known that you're a perfectionist, or do you think it crept? Do you think one day you were like, I can't handle being this way anymore, something has to change? Because you were always an A star student.
Yeah.
So was that...
I was boring as hell. I was the geek in my room.
You did a lot of textbook loving. Yeah,
I was
sure.
Not the one at the parties.
You were not. You did not teach me how to sneak out of my own bedroom or anything to do with boys. That was definitely Jenny.
All right, we didn't have to.
But I had two polar opposite sisters, so I feel very grateful that I certainly did know. I learned how to reference from you in an academic way.
You see?
So there we go. I wouldn't have got through my degree without that, would I?
A lot I have to read.
All of it I'm truly grateful for. So do you think perfectionism was something that you were unaware of for a long time? Do you think it was just like, this is the way I am, this is how I do things, and then as you have gotten older, you sort of recognise that.
Yeah, I think as a teenager or as a child, you kind of feel like everybody's like you, really, don't you? Mm. So you just, you know, or that's how things are. And then you hit the wide world, the bigger world, and I went to uni and I was like, oh, not everybody is like me. maybe this is something that I need to kind of address. Yeah, and then it took me, yeah. And I think then there were probably trigger moments in my life where perfectionism did not serve me at all, and I realised that things needed to change. For example, yeah, it's very easy to be a perfectionist with baby number one because you can focus all of your undivided attention on them. But when baby number two comes along and you need to split your attention, and then you realise that you can't be a perfectionist times two because that's just not possible because you've only got one of you and not two clones, then you can get serious mental health issues, which is what happened to me with the postnatal depression that I had after my second child was born. So I think sometimes in life you just have to hit some sort of rock bottom in order for that change to happen. It's if you're kind of bumbling along and everything's okay, well, you're not going to make a change, are you?
Yeah. Why would it even be a problem if you're bumbling along and coping with it?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what are some of the things that you do other than managing your internal voice? Because I always say, you know, conscious awareness is the first key.
Yeah.
If you don't have conscious awareness of it, you can't change it. So being consciously aware of the strategies that you are employing and when and why you are doing that and how it is, because sometimes it serves and a lot of times it doesn't. Other than that, what strategies do you sort of have on a day-to-day basis for coping with your...
About 5 years ago probably, just after Mum's diagnosis, the first time she was diagnosed with cancer, I was not coping particularly well with that whole situation. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to do something about this because otherwise I could happily, easily go down the depression route again. And I don't want to go back down there. So what do I do? So funnily enough, the friend who uses the term recovering perfectionist, she just mentioned this app called Headspace to me. And I was like, oh, I'll give it a go. Meditation, that's a bit kind of, you know, Buddhist monkey. Not quite sure that's really for me. Bit woo-woo, you know, not sure. But I downloaded it and started it, and I would say that has been my ongoing daily strategy. So I do it on a daily basis, and it's taken 4 years really. I think I probably started seeing the benefits after a year or so, but it's, you know, 4 years in, I am now finding that I am so much more consciously aware than I was before of everything. It's just really, really, really helped me. Mm. And it's helped me, I think the other thing about being human that it's helped me to understand is, as well as a perfectionist, I was kind of, you know, I think most of us do, striving to be happy the whole time, you know?
Yeah.
Got to be happy, got to be filled with joy, got to be, you know, I've got to get everything out of life, I've got to do, you know? And actually, especially over the last few years, I have come to an acceptance that and a realization and a, you know, that actually it's great to be happy, and that's a wonderful emotion to have, but it's also perfectly valid and as reasonable to feel sad, to feel angry, and you can't shirk away from those things. And also perversely, and who knew this was a thing, you can feel ecstatically happy and desperately grief-strickenly sad at the same time, like within 10 minutes of each other. How does that even work? Yeah. That's just ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's true. And so I think that's what meditation has helped me learn, is just all of the emotions, whatever the emotions are, just let them come, let them be, and then notice when they're gone, you know?
Yeah. And that's how they leave.
And that's how they leave, yeah, yeah. Notice them coming, but also notice them going.
Mm.
Yeah.
And
it's fine. You know, humans are not designed to be happy all the time.
No, those are the humans that smoke meth, I think, aren't they? I think that's how that works. Yeah, I completely agree with you. We are designed, we are emotional creatures and we are designed to feel the full spectrum of emotion. And strategies like perfectionism, as an example, Brené Brown calls it the 10-ton shield or the 20-ton shield. You know, perfectionism is if I rock up and I do everything properly and everything correctly and I have a high level of excellence at all times, then I don't ever need to be vulnerable.
Yes.
But of course, vulnerability being the birthplace of creativity and joy and being able to stand there and say, oh my God, I am going to try this new thing and I'm going to fuck it up because it's
like this podcast.
Yeah, totally. Oh my God, yeah. It's like we're on episode 11 and, you know, the first six, someone messaged me the other day. She's like, oh my God, I'm listening to the first episode of your podcast. And I took all of my strength not to reply with, please don't do that. Don't do that. It was shit. It was so bad. But, you know, that is part of what I demonstrate, I hope, which is that, you know, being human is about learning, and in learning is by its very nature failing, because that is, and the paradox of the fail is the success afterwards, and that they are the same thing. And so letting go of that perfectionist strategy is just part of allowing yourself the vulnerability to be able to say, I'm going to give this a go, or I'm going to try this, or hey, I'm not getting this right, but I am trying to get it better next time.
Yeah, and that's how you learn from it as well. That's what Brené Brown says, isn't it? Showing up in the arena. So it's like having the mud on your dust on your face or whatever and just being there.
Yeah.
Giving it a go.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I really, really, really appreciate this. I've just realised that we've been speaking for half an hour. How did that happen? I promised you 20 minutes. I was like, you only need to talk for 20 minutes, please. You're like, okay, but only 20 minutes. And I've just snuck an extra 10 minutes out of you.
I'll invoice you later. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I love you.
I love you too.
My sister, ladies and gentlemen.
Woo!
Woo! My sister, ladies and gentlemen, what a legend. And now it is time for this week's Unashamedly Human moment. This is Carly's real name. She has given me permission. She really wants to own this story. Good on her. Carly from the UK. This came through to me via DM on Instagram, Emily_thatcrazythingcalledlife. But please also feel free to email me and my team info@emilychadbourne.com with your unashamedly human moments and a fake name if you would prefer me to use a fake name. All right, here we go. It's a good one. There was this one time that I was recovering from major surgery. And a week into my stay in hospital, I was still on bed rest. I was in a share room with at least six other patients with just a curtain around my bed for privacy. As I had been on bed rest for a week, I wasn't even allowed to get up to go to the loo. This wasn't so much of a problem, however, as I was heavily, heavily constipated due to my heavy dose of painkillers. Eventually, I couldn't take the build-up any longer, and I asked the nurse for a suppository. Wanting to be sure that the suppository would work, I held it in for an extra 40 minutes rather than the recommended 10 minutes that they suggested. I'm not quite sure what happened next, but before I knew it, there was shit everywhere, with the nurses unable to replace the bedpan at the speed required to catch the shit flying out of me. The six other patients in the room around me did not find the situation particularly palatable, but boy did I feel great and rather lighter after that. I'm pretty sure those nurses will never, ever forget me. So there we go. Don't hold your suppository in for longer than the recommended 10 minutes, and please make sure that you're in a private room before you let anything fly out of you. One of my favourite things actually about that DM was that to begin with, she called it a depository and not a suppository. Made the whole thing much more hilarious for me, if I'm going to be completely honest. So Carly, thank you so much for your unashamedly human moment. It was disgusting, but also divine. For those of you following along at home, please make sure that you head to iTunes, rate, review these podcasts. It really helps other people hear this material. You can also catch me on YouTube. Please subscribe and please tell your mates about it. Use the hashtag #unashamedlyhuman. Be sure to join my free Facebook group, That Crazy Thing Called Life. And thank you very much for listening.
If you're anything like me, your first thought in the morning is often one of, oh, holy fuck. We wake up instantly feeling like we're in lack. Not enough sleep, not enough time, not enough. We scroll through social media and feel not enough. We think about our day ahead and feel underprepared, uninspired, or overwhelmed. What if we're not enough? Before we're even out of bed, our mind is telling us all sorts of crazy stories, and these stories set the precedent for our day and have a huge effect on our results. Imagine if you could start your day with a different thought. Imagine waking up to a daily reminder of the greatness that lies within you. Imagine having your own personal and funny cheerleader inspiring you every single day. Imagine your first waking thought being one of abundance and purpose. Well, imagine no longer, my friend, because now you can wake up with M. Wake Up With M is a text message service for women who are ready to wake up to their power, purpose, and passion. A daily motivational message from me personally to get you smiling into your day and vibing high from the moment you wake up, and all for less than the price of a couple of lattes a month. And even better, you get the first month completely for free. Because, well, you know, you might actually find it really annoying to have a daily reminder that you're amazing and capable and awesome. Head to emilychabourne.com/wakeup or check out the link in the show notes below.